On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we review ALCS Game 1. I am here in Toronto. Watched that one last night. We'll talk about it. Talk about how that series may play out. Review the bananas, not the Savannah Bananas, the bananas that was Game 5 of the ALDS against the Tigers. Tigers-Mariners, Brewers-Cubs Game 5, Brewers-Dodgers. Man, this time of year just fuels your soul. Here we go. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world eating poutine at 2 a.m. and recording a show at 8:45. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And I'm in Toronto. Not Toronto, mind you. C-H-R-O-N-O.
Yeah, I'm not sure how I would spell it perfectly, but I know what you're getting at, and I'm glad you are there in Canada. I know it is a city. Have you even been to? I know you haven't been to a game there. Have you been to the city before? No. All right.
This is the burbs.
The Toronto debut. All right. How about that? All right. Well, Jake is there. He just watched Game 1 of the American League Championship Series. A lot has happened since we last recorded this podcast.
Oh, my God.
Really, most specifically, a lot of Mariners baseball has occurred since we last recorded this podcast. We had our double Game 5 preview on Friday, and now we have a Game 1 recap, a Game 1 preview. And yes, we are going to take some time to talk about that Game 5 in Seattle on Friday night. The Game 5 in Milwaukee, probably won't spend as much time on it, but we do get to talk about the Brewers for another round. Our NLCS preview is coming up a little bit later. But Jake, our opener today on this Monday morning is ALCS Game 1.
It wasn't as scintillating, heart-stopping, nail-bitingly tense as ALDS Game 5. And frankly, for everybody's mental health, that's probably for the best. ALCS Game 1 between the Seattle Mariners and Toronto Blue Jays took place last night here at Rogers Center. Not the Rogers Center, as I am slowly beginning to learn. And it was, I would say, relatively straightforward. I'll run through the main beats of it. George Springer goes yard on the first pitch in the bottom of the first. The first pitch seen by a Toronto Blue Jay, hitting a backside laser into the right field seats. His 21st postseason home run of his career, moving him into fifth place on the all-time list, untying him with Derek Jeter. He trails only Manny Ramirez, Jose Altuve, Kyle Schwarber, and Bernie Williams on that list. Autumn George was back. And the place was bumping, right? Like, Mariners kind of make some noise in the top of the first. Cal Raleigh's thrown out on a bang-bang play at home by Addison Barger. They get out of the inning with no runs. Gossman shuts it down. They score right away and feels like the lid's going to pop off the place, right? The air's vibrating in the dome. And then Bryce Miller walks a couple guys in that first, but he gets it back on the rails. Miller working on short rest for like the first time in probably his professional career, throws six innings and is absolutely sensational. Cal Raleigh, who else, changes the game with a mega tank in the sixth inning off of Kevin Gossman. Gossman had retired, I believe, 15 straight Mariners between the first inning and the sixth inning. Cal stops that trend. It is his ninth home run in 14 career games in Toronto, which is just, he gets to call it Toronto. He gets to call it whatever he wants at this point, frankly. Jorge Polanco, go ahead, single two batters later. And this is all with two outs. Julio walk. They bring in, I believe it was Brendan Little, to face Jorge Polanco, which was the overanalyzed move of the night from Jays manager John Schneider, not sticking with Gossman, who was not at too many pitches, and bringing in a lefty to face a switch hitter to switch him around, where you could have just gone, you know, kept Gossman in there and brought the switch hitter in for the next guy. worth reviewing, maybe. They bring in Little to face Polanco. The month of Jorge Polanco continues. He smacks a single, scores a run. They score again, I believe, an inning later. Two innings later to make it 3-1. Also on a Polanco single. The Mariners' bullpen is perfect. Gabe Spier, Matt Brash, Andres Munoz, 24 pitches, 9 up, 9 down, and the Mariners leave game one with an invigorating victory despite having slept like 2 hours in the last 48.
Yeah, and obviously coming off of Friday's game, which we will get to in a little bit. That said, the travel is something that the Mariners know as well as anybody. And even that one off day is a real thing for a team that is used to flying cross-continent quite frequently. Now, I will also point out that the Mariners did not do particularly well on the East Coast this year. That's like where all of their low points on the season came, on the road on the East Coast. So that was something that certainly came to mind as they headed east. But boy, oh boy, did they show up. And I mean, yeah, I think, of course, the Cal homer is a huge deal. But Bryce Miller, I mean, to throw 27 pitches in the first inning, forget the first inning, the first two batters, gives up the homer to Springer on the first pitch. And then he has this, 12 pitches, 13 pitch battle with Nathan Lucas that ends in a walk. And then he throws ball one to Vlad Jr. And at that point, you're like, well, this is kind of going about as poorly, but also how you might expect a game like this to go, right? This was following. It's like, all right, this one might get away from them. We might just see the Mariners essentially, you know, throw Emerson Hancock out there and, the, you know, the bottom of the bullpen and say, you know what? This was not to be. We will rally tomorrow and we will go from here. And instead, not only does he get out of that first inning without allowing any more runs, over the next five scoreless, he throws 49 pitches. And this is where this game is just an amazing box score to look at. And I was tweeting a bunch of stats about it last night. 100 total pitches for the Mariners. Those relievers each threw 8 pitches apiece. The Blue Jays had 2 hits. And that is the story. They had 1 hit after Springer hit the first pitch of the game out.
Yeah.
And what, 2 other base runners? I mean, that's the story. And you mentioned that the moment with Polanco and, Schneider's decision to do this. Whatever. It's the same conversation we had about the Phillies bunt. It's like, who cares? Right. You didn't hit. And you really didn't hit in this one. And against the Mariners pitching staff that you would think would be totally gassed. And for Bryce Miller, who's only gone 6 innings once all season, it was an amazing showing from the Mariners pitchers. And it was a very much the opposite of amazing showing for the Blue Jays bats.
And their inability to get any sort of traffic was significant, too, because, you know, in the playoffs, a base runner is a rally. That's particularly true at home, where you're forcing pitchers to go from the stretch and the energy ramps up and you can feel the tension in the building. And that didn't happen. Like, there just weren't base runners. And that allowed the Mariners pitchers to cruise. And I think it's super relevant how few pitches that trio threw, because they're all going to be relatively fresh today for game two, right? Where you could have envisioned a world where they maybe would have kept Spire or Brash down today if they had thrown a ton of pitches last night, and that was not what happened. Let's just briefly talk about Gausman. I mean, he was great. Mm-hmm. He was amazing, yep. Right? Like, he has those 2 base hits in the first inning, and then he retires 15 guys in a row. And, you know, I think that Cal at bat is so important just because that's what that and then the Julio walk. Very rarely does a Julio Rodriguez walk change the tenor of a baseball game. But it did. So he throws a 2-1 splitter to Cal. And it's like 5 balls below the zone, like clearly a ball. And Cal scoops it out and smacks one foul, like hard down the line. And at that point, it was pretty clear that he was hunting the splitter. Now, hundreds of humbled stoles have hunted the splitter against Mr. Kevin Gausman to no success, right? And so to be like, hey, why didn't you realize he was hunting the splitter is a silly thing to say. But in his post-game interview, Cal was pretty open about, as much as Cal Raleigh can be, that he was looking splitter in that spot. And you can tell by just the way he swings, right? Like, he is trying to scoop that ball from the bottom of the strike zone up and out. Now, he said, like, I wasn't trying to do too much, blah, blah, blah. The Gausman pitch caught enough of the bottom of the zone where it was not a swing and miss pitch. It was not down enough. That miss is huge. Cal hits at 420. I mean, it was an awesome home run, because where the press box is at Rogers Center is like down the left field line. And so it was a great view of that thing arcing, and there was not a doubt in the building. Silence the place. They score later in the inning. And, you know, the crowd last night was great. When they had something to cheer about just in the early going, the dome makes that place very loud, but it's like you can only make as much noise as what you're given. And the Blue Jays did not give a lot.
Yeah. A couple things on that. I'm glad you mentioned Cal and the splitter. You know, you mentioned he was probably looking for the splitter in the second at bat. He got five of them and he struck out, and that's because Gausman executed the pitch better. But that is what is interesting about that pitch in particular, is the difference between the nastiest and most impossible pitch to hit around and the ball going 420 feet is really a small margin. You know, the splitter is a pitch that can be hit a very, very long way if you locate it poorly to the wrong person. And this wasn't right in the middle. It wasn't up, but it was in the zone, and it was able for him to be getting. And you compare them to every other splitter he threw Cal Raleigh, which, as you mentioned, were below the zone. That was the difference. And when you're raising someone that good, you are gonna pay with a ball that goes over the fence. But again, at that point, it's a solo homer, and you still think that the Blue Jays, not like the Mariners run away with it, and the Blue Jays never managed to put up any sort of fight offensively.
I want to hop in there. You say, like, when you're facing a player that caliber, The margins in October are so small, and like, you have to execute your pitches all the time, and that can be exhausting, and that level of focus is part of what made Game 5 so preposterous. And I think for Cal Raleigh, despite his regular season, right, hitting 60 home runs, entering October, it was like, okay, is this the kind of player that can instill fear and have a presence in a lineup in October? We saw that dynamic so perfectly last year with the Yankees, right, in the playoffs, where it was like, Juan Soto is horrifying. He is the hitter in October you never want to face. Whereas teams felt like they could sequence Judge. Now, that obviously changed this postseason. Judge was on fire. And so the question was like, is Cal going to be that guy? Kyle Tucker was not that guy this October, right? The presence was not there in the same way. And I think through five Mariners playoff games, I feel pretty good that Raleigh's regular season has carried over, where you need to execute against this guy. You need to make your pitches or else he will burn you. And like, not to say that I was doubting Cal Raleigh, but I think that that is a cool and encouraging development, that this is not just like 162 hot games. this is legit, everybody.
He's clearly leveled up, right? And it is interesting because we're still dealing with small samples. But that balance, that blend of what makes a hitter scary in October, Ohtani, we're going to talk about him, you know, in the next segment, the struggles he had against Philadelphia. He's still terrifying. You know, he did go 1-for-18 with 9 strikeouts. He is still terrifying because, you know,
the Phillies still intentionally walked him. In game four.
Right. And by the way, the Mariners have another hitter in this lineup that is also very interesting from this regard, which is Julio, who also has been pitched around a little bit, intentionally walked in certain spots, is clearly susceptible to chase out of the zone. Is clearly, if you could sequence him, you can absolutely get him out. And he has not been nearly consistent. He's had some huge hits for sure as well, but we've seen him go cold. But Cal has pretty much, while he's had some punch outs mixed in, I mean, he's pretty much contributed in all of these games, you know, not to mention all the catching. But other than that, I mean, Polanco, of course, we were going to talk about him in game five, even if he didn't do anything in this one. But he, you know, delivers two more big hits. I had the stat that his hardest hit ball from the right side of his career, which is really what makes the John Schneider move look silly. Now, again, that's coincidence, I guess, but it's like, all right, we got to turn this guy around. We'd rather him bat right-handed. He's like, great, I will hit it harder than I ever have from this side. So Polanco is obviously locked in, but man, I still just keep thinking about Bryce Miller and what that was for him. Again, it's not like he struck out 12, but it was a really impressive show, and Cal obviously has something to do with that too, and he's also a good reminder of like, dude's got a lot of pitches. All these Mariners pitchers got a lot of pitches, and he can really kitchen sink them. And especially when you're throwing 97, it's a little harder to kitchen sink when you're throwing 93. If you have two fastballs and your command is good enough, you're going to keep guys. And obviously the Blue Jays were being aggressive and really scoring much up after the first inning. He was able to cruise.
And that's what makes Cal Raleigh, to keep talking about him. Like it's one thing if you're catching a starting pitcher who has three pitches, right? Cal Raleigh is out here handling this Mariners staff where everybody has like 15 pitches, right? And somehow in the time between J.P. Crawford touching home plate and the Mariners starting the game last night, Cal Raleigh had to study up on every single Toronto hitter and how the Mariners pitching staff is going to play against those hitters with their very deep arsenals. And that's just an added element to all the things that go on his plate and why, if you made me choose, I guess there's gun control in this country. So if you put a knife to my head, I would probably pick Cal Raleigh. And the thing also, dude, I was just impressed that the Mariners didn't look tired last night. I know there was a day off in the middle, and they didn't work out.
Yeah.
On the off day, but they looked like they got some sleep, which was very impressive. I told you this story off the air, how I was, bantering with a Mariners employee who will remain nameless. And I was like, yeah, it'll be interesting to see how Bryce Miller goes on short rest tonight. And this Mariners employee was like, short rest? He's not on short rest. I was like, I'm pretty sure he is. Like, I know it feels like you guys have not played. Like, it's been 3 weeks since he last pitched game four. He threw game four on Tuesday in Detroit, right? And so it's like feels like a millennia ago, but no, Bryce Miller
Wednesday
is indeed Wednesday short rest.
Wednesday in Detroit. Wednesday. Yeah. So anyway, no, it's a great, but it's back to what I said before. Mariners are used to traveling more than everybody else, and clearly that paid off. All right, so Mariners take game one, very impressive. Game two, here's some more fun facts about just the absurd week that it's been for Seattle. Logan Gilbert will take the hill again after his heroic relief outing that we will get to shortly. And rookie Trey Savage, who dominated the Yankees more than a week ago, will take the hill for Toronto. Logan Gilbert has pitched twice since Trey Savage dominated the Yankees. He started that game three in Detroit, looked great. He came in extras in relief against Detroit in game five. So Logan Gilbert's thrown eight innings over two games and I think over 100 pitches over those two outings. And clearly the strategic thing, well, the two main points here, and then I'll kick it to you here. One is, as they did in the first series, some of their pitchers, as talented as they are, have extreme splits home versus road, especially this year. Luis Castillo is the most extreme example of that. Logan Gilbert, they trust more on the road in terms of the profile. And so, again, it's a lot to ask because of how much Logan Gilbert has pitched recently, but they are going to go with Gilbert in game two so that Castillo and then Kirby, who, of course, is going to need the most rest coming off of game five, is going to go presumably in game four. Brian Wu is on the roster. We don't know when we're going to see him. Is he going to start? Is he going to relieve? Who knows? But that is the calculus behind Gilbert pitching again already in game two.
I very quickly want to talk about Gilbert's facial hair. I think for a lot of baseball fans who think about the Mariners pitching rotation, often it all gets lumped into like the Mariners have a bunch of good pitchers and then like they don't always get separated. And I think that's because like some years Bryce Miller is the best one. And like this year, Brian Wu is the best one. And like 3 years ago, it was Logan Gilbert. And so I think they get lost a little bit. Logan Gilbert does distinguish himself with one of the wonkier facial hair choices in the big leagues. Have you talked to people around the Mariners about his goatee? It looks like he is in witness protection. Like that he was like, hey, we need you to not look like you.
Yeah, so this is something that was not present earlier in his career, and he's kind of started to lean into it. I want to say he had it a little bit last year, but now he's really grown it out, for better or for worse. I do agree with you. I have not talked to anyone specifically about it, because again, I'm used to looking at these players all the time. It's a fair point.
We talk about this all the time. We had a former a boss of ours who's a very good friend, Gemma Kaneko, when we were at MLB.com. And she would always say to us, guys, make strong choices. You know, make That's strong true. Creative choices. Yeah. And I would say that this from Logan Gilbert is a very strong creative choice. Very quickly on Trey Savage. So he spoke yesterday on the podium. And the most entertaining thing that came out was that when he went to the bullpen in game 4 in New York, he was not under any circumstances going to throw. That was a complete decoy from John Schneider, the Blue Jays manager. And that, you know, Trey had some fun going out there and pretending like he was going to be in that ballgame when he was not. I am very interested to see how he performs. It's smart, again, that they're having him be at home. They want him to be in this environment. It will be his fifth career big league start. And it's like, okay, the Mariners really struggled with the splitter until they did it in game 1. How do things play in game 2 when Savage is coming out there with an even more unique kind of release point and profile than Gausman?
Yeah, I mean, listen, if he's executing, I think they're going to have a really tough time, because it's the same thing. Or they've never seen him, you know. The difference is that Trey Savage is coming into this game down 1-0. Like, it's more about how he handles that scenario of if they do start fouling off pitches, if they do start building the pitch count, putting some balls in play. Whereas he was just coasting in that first game. Remember, he had the huge lead and they were up in the series. Like, not that he doesn't get credit for dominating a good Yankees lineup.
There was no adversity. There was no adversity in that game.
There really wasn't, right? And so, again, very talented. I would not be surprised if he goes out and throws 5 good innings again, because he is so funky and his stuff is so good. But this is not the same thing. It's not the same thing. Not because the Mariners are better than the Yankees, but because the situation is very different.
He's not going to throw 7, right? He was perfect, no hit through 5 1/3, right. I believe. And they still pulled him because, you know, he started the year in Dunedin, and so they're not going to push him past a certain limit. That means that the Mariners, even if they get obliterated by Trey Savage, will have a chance in the 5th, 6th, 7th against the weaker pockets of the Jays' pen.
Yeah, and that's another big part of how Game 1 went is, you know, we saw almost all of the Jays' A relievers, who presumably they'll be available again in Game 2, but you started to get some looks at them. Some of them had success, some of them didn't, and it all compounds. We just saw it in the last series, at least until Game 5, where the Mariners' relievers were invincible, but we've seen that version, and especially when we're talking about over a 7-game series, we know that this can definitely play a role as well. So I think, I mean, it's a huge opportunity for both pitchers. There's different pressures and expectations for both because of the experience, because of the talent level, because of what Logan Gilbert just did. It makes you both more and less confident, because this is, you know, you could say, oh, well, Game 5 was just his side day. Well, okay, obviously it was a little bit different than that. So this is going to be a pretty serious ask for Logan Gilbert. And how much does he have in the tank, too? I mean, this is
right.
We're really pushing him from a workload standpoint in ways that we haven't seen. And I'm curious to see how he handles it. Anything else on Game 2 before we talk about that other game?
We need to, we have toed around this long enough. Game 5, ALDS, we need to talk about it. It was a marathon. It was grueling. It was exhausting. It was draining. Jordan is still recovering from the emotional experience. It was one of the most unforgettable baseball games of the 21st century, like straight up. A baseball game in October reaches that point when people on Twitter that don't usually watch baseball are like, See this baseball game that's still going? And that's what happened the other night. Jordan, 72 hours have now passed since this. We thought about recording in the moment. We just couldn't make it work. Your raw reaction is done and dusted. But as you look back at it now with the hindsight of 3 days, like, what are your takeaways and feelings as someone who cares deeply about the Seattle Mariners?
Yeah, I mean, it was amazing. And yeah, apologies we couldn't deliver a night of. It was Friday night at, 1 a.m. when it ended, and I had to write words, which I was happy to do. And it was an interesting assignment to try and encapsulate that. Obviously, during the postseason, we're lucky enough to travel, but sometimes we're doing recap and from our desk or from the couch. And there are pros and cons of recapping games when you're not actually there, I would say, because in some ways it's a little bit easier to focus, but then it's also, it feels like you're telling a different story. So I couldn't pretend to tell a story about the celebration and all that stuff because I wasn't there. And so I tried to capture what that game was like to watch and all the biggest moments. And I think that was what was so cool is every way that a run was scored was memorable. And of course, part of that is obvious because there weren't very many runs scored, but the fact that you had all the runs that were scored, Naylor stealing third and scoring on a sac fly after stealing third because Scooble can't hear because his teammates are telling him to step off and he can't hear. The Cary Carpenter homer is an amazing, Cary Carpenter, one of the great games in postseason history, reached base 6 times. What a performance by him, but he was the only Tiger that could really do anything. And then the Leo Rivas moment. I mean, unbelievable, right? The pinch hit moment, the guy first postseason appearance, player appearance of his life, the Bizzardo outing, all the Mariners relievers, of which somehow overshadows, sort of, Tarek Skubal, right? And I know that the discourse from that game was, how does he not come back out after 99 pitches? And I mean, AJ Hinch was extremely honest about it. He was like, what do you mean? That was an easy decision. Like, he was done. He emptied the tank. And that is an interest. I think if we had more time, I think that there is something interesting about that premise and like what that says about the game, what it says about Skubal. And to me, it's easy to be like, dude, whatever. Like, Tarek Skubal did his job. I'm sorry. Like, if you say, would they have won the game if he went out? If he went out there for the seventh, maybe. I think there are a lot of people on the Mariners side that probably feel that way. But
I feel that way.
I don't know.
That's sort of disagree. I sort of disagree.
Yeah, I guess I'm. I should phrase it differently.
Yeah.
Let me say it slightly differently. That there's a really the premise of AJ Hinch being like he was done. That was not a hard decision. Sure. I think that is very interesting, and I think that we can learn something from that for better or for worse. You could disagree with it. That is compelling, but I do totally understand why people felt the way that they did.
This is very niche. I think back to it was Wild Card Game 2. Where Fernando Cruz got that like deep fly out to center field and then like freaked out, like screaming coming off the mound. And I think on the broadcast, Eduardo Perez was like, he's done. Because there is something about this emotional release when a guy comes off a mound and like he screams and he's like particularly demonstrative after getting the final out of an inning that makes it seem as if his emotional energy is spent, right? That there was like a release of some sort. And I think that is both fair and deceptive because I think that like after that last pitch that Tarek Skubal had, he just blew a heater right by Cal Raleigh to strike him out. Like, do I think that Tarek Skubal probably was acting like that was his last pitch? Maybe. Do I think that Tarek Skubal could just like drink some water and roll back out there for the seventh inning? Yes. And I think look, I get you have to trust Kyle Finnegan, whatever. I would rather go down with my guy. To me, it's that simple. Like, I would rather lose the season with Tarek Skubal giving up 2 runs in the seventh inning than, I guess, what happened. Now, again, the offense didn't show up for Detroit. It was that simple. Whatever. But I just... If Tarek Skubal can't get that seventh inning, then who can? Right?
Yeah.
In that spot.
And that's the thing.
And I think that's why I disagree with AJ. That's why I disagree with Hinch. It's like, I understand what he's saying. He was done. I think the fact that AJ said it was not a difficult decision, that is wrong. Like, that perspective to me is preposterous, because it wasn't a difficult decision. Brother, this should be a difficult decision. Like, that's the best pitcher on the planet. Like, I understand he knows him better, and I get that AJ Hinch is better at his job than I am at mine, right? And it is difficult to throw stones at critique where I'm sitting here, you know, in shorts, blabbering on a podcast. I'm not in the dugout. I don't have that type of perspective. But it should be a difficult decision.
I'm with you. Again, here's the quote. Asked about it. He said, you know, the stress level of Skubal, Mounty pitch, was it a pretty straightforward decision to go with Finnegan? Yeah, easy decision. After the fifth, I checked on him, how he was doing physically and emotionally. We both knew he had one left. You know, he emptied the tank and obviously was emotional coming off the mound. I think that signals exactly we were in the game. He gave us everything he could. So that's fine. I'm with you. It is an interesting thing, because that seems like a manager knowing his player. But I also totally hear your perspective and hear why people feel that way, including people on the Mariners side that are just like, if Tarek Skubal stays in the game, do they ever score? But as you mentioned, the story is the Tigers 2-5 hitters going 0-23. Jake, that's not going to get the job done in a winner-take-all postseason game. And Kerry Carpenter did all he could. But this was ultimately a microcosm of kind of how the Tigers showed at the end of this season offensively. We're going to get to the Tigers a little bit more specifically later on, so I'll move them to the side. But as far as this game goes, like, we could have done a whole pod on it, but just so many memorable moments. And just the pitching and extra innings from both sides. The Tigers getting multiple double plays in extra innings. Like, there was just time after time after time. And the other thing about it is, of course, everyone's making the comparison to 2022. And honestly, in 2022, I remember the hitters being even more hopeless. The 18 inning game against Houston, I don't remember even feeling like anyone had a chance of scoring. Whereas you had those near calls multiple times in extra innings for both teams where you thought it was going to happen moments, and then it would go.
Yeah. There were moments in this game where, like, the pitcher would come in and he would, like, go 2-0 on the first hitter, and you're like, he doesn't have
Flaherty inning. The Flaherty inning. Oh my goodness. Oh, it was like, there's no way he's getting out of this. And he somehow did. So, I mean, listen, it was an all timer. It was one of the greatest pitch games of all time. Every single batter struck out at least once, except for Josh Naylor, who had himself one hell of a game. And
should we talk about what a performance Mariners from this sliders Mariners usage?
Oh yes. The Mariners threw, here's a fun fact. Mariners threw more sliders in game 5 than they threw total pitches in game 1 against the Blue Jays, which is 104.
Incredible.
They threw 104 sliders on the evening against Detroit. It was very clear that was the game plan for Kirby. And then obviously they have plenty of relievers who rely quite heavily on their sliders. And Tigers couldn't do much with that.
Here's a very niche reference that only you will understand. You playing NHL 10 with your brother and the Mariners turning the sliders way up. There you go. The last thing I want to talk about before we take a break is Humpy. Have to admit, I knew about the Mariners salmon race, but I was not familiar with the specific characters, because I have not been to T-Mobile Park in a long time. Since, I guess,
it's only a two-year thing that hasn't existed for very long. So
like many of the other, you know, teams around the league, the Mariners have instituted a race between innings with various mascot characters. This is something that happens in D.C. with the Presidents. It happens with the Sausages in Milwaukee. With the Diamondbacks have one where it's just like old, you know, legendary players. The Mariners.
Pierogies in Pittsburgh.
Started.
Yep.
Yeah, the Mariners started a salmon race because salmon is important up there. You know, going to go watch the salmon, going to go the salmon run. I think that's the joke. Mm-hmm. It's a salmon run. Mm-hmm. And the four salmon characters, I believe, let's see if I can do this, are Sockeye. And they all have, like, personalities, I learned. Mm-hmm. So there's, like, Sockeye is, like, the Nirvana grunge salmon. There's Silver, which is, like, the tech bro salmon. There's Humpy, who is like the lovable loser, bumbling idiot salmon. And then there's King Salmon, which is like a royal Felix Hernandez themed salmon. Now, Humpy, as the, the loser, had never won. Humpy was winless. And so there was a Let Humpy Win campaign. There was a Never Let Humpy Win campaign. Similar to how the Nats, I believe, for 10 years didn't let Teddy Roosevelt win in the president's race.
Yes.
Let Teddy win. It was always funny that the Nats picked Teddy Roosevelt to be the loser because it was like not really his persona as a figure in American history, right? Like kind of the opposite. Anyway, Humpy won. Humpy won not during the traditional race, which I believe takes place in the fifth inning, but during the second salmon run, which took place in the 15th inning, because the Mariners played a 15-inning game and did another salmon race and let Humpy win. When you look at like the seismic noise rumble data that they always have in Seattle for earthquakes and sports matches, the Polanco hit showed up, but the Humpy winning also showed up. The crowd went berserk for Humpy.
Yeah, and it clearly for them to win immediately after that is really something. But it shows that it is a great amount. The Mariners are good at this stuff. This is the kind of thing, whether it's the in-game stuff, the promotional stuff, they do this stuff well. And that arm of the Mariners operation has certainly done quite well this postseason, and I expect them to continue. I look forward to seeing the salmon run on Wednesday in Game 3.
And it impacted the game. Like, when you're in those moments, and like, I'm not saying the crowd needs something to get up, but like, you know, extra innings can be a slog, and like, there hasn't been beer sales for, you know, 2.5 hours, and you know, you're on your feet the whole time. Having Humpy win jazzed that crowd back up, and I'm sure that's exactly why Tommy Canely didn't have it in his half of the inning. Jordan, let's take a break, and when we get back, we will preview the NLCS and review Brewers' victory in Game 5. And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Enough about the American League. Let's do the NL and preview the NLCS. And we have to begin with the Milwaukee Brewers knocking off the Chicago Cubs in a winner-take-all Game 5 at American Family Field, Miller Park in my heart. This game was pretty straightforward. Jacob Mizorowski was good for 4 innings after allowing a solo home run to Seiya Suzuki. The Brewers hit 3 solo shots, which is a hilarious way for the Brewers to win a series. William Contreras, Andrew Vaughn, Bryce Rang. Cubs were only able to score on that Suzuki homer, and the Brewers win Game 5, 3-1. Their bullpen steps up big time. They have Trevor McGill as the opener. Very WWE-style performance from him. Clean first inning, gets out of it, walks off the mound, just screaming, pumping up the crowd. That's called emptying the tank, my dear friends.
Yes.
Then they bring in Aaron Ashby, who they need to stop bringing in because that guy does not have it right now. Here's something that's maybe a little mean. My sister sent me a picture of the television with a picture of Aaron Ashby and said, "What's wrong with this guy?"
I mean, if she's been watching, anytime Aaron Ashby's come in the last 3 games, stuff has started to go wrong. But I don't know.
But they call
focused on.
Yeah, they call upon. So he puts 2 guys on, and they call upon the fireman, Chad Patrick, who comes in, escapes the jam. He goes another inning, hands it off to Abner Uribe, who closes it out. And that was that. The Brew Crew rumbles on, banishing their early round demons, advancing to the NLCS for a David versus Goliath showdown with the big money Los Angeles Dodgers.
Quickly on Chad Patrick, that was such an awesome performance, and it'll be interesting how he is used for this upcoming series. He had a tremendous rookie year, but eventually lost his rotation spot. His rookie year was a lot of starts that were just it was just like solid, 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 solid. At no point was he blowing people away. Stuff was very average. To see that guy come out of the bullpen throwing 97 and just like, you know, screaming coming off the mound. It was like, whoa, okay, that's a different pitcher. That is a totally different dude. So we know with the Brewers, they are going to get creative, get into their 27 outs, and credit to him. You know, I expressed some skepticism before game five that they were going to be able to patch it together. And they did it, and then they made it look pretty simple. And I shouldn't have been surprised. As we foresaw, Mizrowski was the key, and he gave them those four innings, and he was quite good. But it only took five pitchers, and Uribe gave him two, as I'm sure we were expecting them. The McGill as the opener was an intriguing wrinkle that I don't think we saw coming. But credit to him, man. They got it done. And then obviously Cubs, same story as the Tigers. They didn't hit, except in this case, the Cubs, who had generally – they have hitters who you expect to hit in a much more real way. They didn't do that. But we'll talk about the Cubs more later, so let's focus on Milwaukee.
Are you familiar with Chad Patrick's nickname? What manager Pat Murphy calls him?
Oh, yeah. I'm forgetting. You told me this at some point during the season.
Hot Dog Kid.
Do we know what the origin? I can't remember what the origin of that is.
In AAA for the Nashville Sounds, Chad Patrick had a hot dog during a game, I believe, in the bullpen maybe. And he then returned from the road trip to find a hot dog, like an Oscar Mayer hot dog roller in his locker.
Yeah.
And so he proceeded to just like make hot dogs all the time with his hot dog roller in his locker. Pat Murphy obviously found that to be hilarious and just referred to him during a pregame media availability that I was at early this year. He was like, yeah, you know, we got a lot of arms on the injured list. Like we got Tobias Myers, we got Gasser and Ashby and Hot Dog Kid. And, you know, the Brewers media people laugh. And I think Andy McCullough of The Athletic was there too. And we looked at each other and we're like, what? And I said, hey, Murph, you know, for those of us who aren't around the team all the time, who is Hot Dog Kid? And he was like, Chad Patrick. They're like, okay. On the record, I believe, referred to Chad Patrick as, quote, not exactly an Ivy League type, which is just a hilarious thing to say about one of your players. But I guess overlap there with Hot Dog Kid is kind of perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. Tough look for Purdue Northwest. Anyway, the Brewers advance, and while we've seen the Brewers in a lot of postseason games over the last decade, it's like, does this feel as momentous for them to get to this point as, you know, the Mariners and the Blue Jays? And the answer is relatively no, but also yes, because this team has flopped in the first round over and over and over since their last NLCS appearance in 2018, and this time they came dangerously close. They had a 2-0 lead. They went and didn't look great in Chicago, and they came home, and they took care of business, and now they have home field against the Dodgers, just as they did 7 years ago.
Well, this is the thing. This Brewers team has been presented as different to the preceding Brewers teams, and that is both because they led the league in baseball. I mean, they did kind of lead the league in baseball. They led baseball in wins, right? And I think that the way that they went about it, like they were the best team all season long. And I think that the Brewers had, like, even the last couple of years, like they were not the best team. They were disappointed when they crashed out early. But this year was like, you need to win. And it is reassuring to me that they did. Let's preview this very, very, very compelling NLCS. You mentioned that they faced off in the 2018 NLCS. I believe you tweeted this out, but only six players remain on these rosters, three on each from that NLCS.
Yes, and only five of them are even going to be, you know, involved, since Brandon Woodruff does not sound like he's going to be healthy enough to rejoin the Brewers quite yet. But he was, of course, around back in 2018, as was Christian Yelich. That was his first year as a Brewer. How about that? And that was like, holy crap, Christian Yelich, right?
Wow.
I mean, that was like, remember, he showed up, which is immediately one of the, you know, three best players in baseball. So Yelich, of course, was there. Freddie Peralta was a rookie that year. He did pitch in that series, I believe, out of the bullpen. So he was there in 2018. And then on the Dodgers side, of course, Clayton Kershaw, he's been around a minute. Max Muncy, should he that be was involved? His first year with the Dodgers. Should he be involved this time? That is a good question, but I still expect him to be on the roster, I think. Maybe I'll be wrong about that. And then Max Muncy, yeah, his first year with the Dodgers. I mean, we think about him as a Dodgers lifer, but that is very much not true. So he was an Oakland A there for a little bit before he broke out in LA in 2018. And he was really like by one of their best hitters that year. You know, you go back and look at that 2018 Dodgers team. We know they make the World Series, of course. It was a balanced team. It was a very good team. They had Manny Machado very memorably, but especially on the mound and then certainly, you know, in the lineup, they had a lot of really good players. The stats, though, were not quite as eye-popping across the board, but Muncy was awesome. And then Kike was on that team as well, of course. Now he's, you know, left and came back, but we'll still count him. So not too much overlap, but that was a very memorable series. I mean, that went seven games. The Brewers had home field. They basically alternated wins throughout the series until the end, where the Dodgers took game seven in Milwaukee. Moved on to get their
ass whooped. This is when Brandon Woodruff,
the Red Sox,
went yard off of Kershaw. Mm-hmm. There was a moment in the series, I remember, where the Brewers had like Wade Miley start 2 days in a row, where like they wanted to flip the lineup and like they like wanted him as a lefty. So he like threw to one batter and then they took him out because you could do that back then.
Oh, right. That's true. Yeah, that's I think you absolutely nailed that, actually, which is pretty impressive. Wade Miley started three of these seven games. So I think you're right about that. Do you want to know who pitched the other two? This is kind of wild. Again, it's like how much has changed since the Brewers. So Corbin Burnes was in the bullpen. So that's funny, obviously. Do you know who started the four other games? I don't know. This would be really wild if you could remember this.
Oh, Jalice Chacin.
Yes.
Was he started on this twice. Team.
Yep. And then Brent Suter? Gio Gonzalez started two of the other games. And then for the Dodgers, these starts belong to two for Kershaw, two for Walker Buehler, who was, of course, awesome, Rich Hill, and then two for Hyunjin Ryu. So anyway, obviously, many of these players have moved on from these teams and from baseball in many cases. But some of them will remember, and there will be two many of these games. References. Yeah. So that's the thing about it's like, oh, well, the Brewers have the pitching to get through this series. It's like, well, I know they won more games than the Dodgers that year, but I'm looking at some of these pitchers and I'm like, anyway, so what are we thinking about going into this series? So obviously you have this kind of conflicting narratives. You have the Brewers, who by payroll and by reputation and by history, they are the underdogs, indisputably. Absolutely. Nobody's on their team's making any money besides Christian Yelich. Their payroll's a fourth of what the Dodgers is. They've never won the World Series, yada, yada, yada. All true. All correct. Indisputable, right? Then you have the fact that the Brewers were the best team in baseball, and they went 6-0 against the Dodgers in the regular season. And we'll have home field in this series. And so you'd basically have these two just like, okay, well, this is clearly true, but then this is also a reality that I have been watching for the entirety of this season. How am I supposed to balance these and make a pick? And we will make picks at the end of the segment, but that is what we are dealing with here. And I think what makes it even more challenging is the fact that the Dodgers over these first two rounds have reminded us what they are capable of, particularly on the mound with the starting pitching, in a way that is so disparate to what Milwaukee is able to do from a starting pitching standpoint that it makes it feel like in a particularly daunting proposition, and where I expect a lot of people to just be like, yeah, Dodgers in five, whatever. I don't know if we're going to do that. We're going to find out. But that is the challenge of looking at this series, is one set of facts that tells you that one team should obviously be favored over the other, and then the other set of history facts that say, and roster and talent and what we're used to, and being like, well, clearly the Dodgers are still better.
Brewers manager Pat Murphy gave a funny little interview after they won the NLDS with Scott Grodzki, who is a reporter in Milwaukee, where he said, quote, "I don't know how many of our guys would make their team, but it ain't about that. It's about how we came together as a team and compete." And like, that is true. Every reliever, Pat, every reliever on the Brewers probably would just be on the dock. Like, I don't know how many of our guys would make their team. The pitchers probably in the bullpen probably would. It'd be all the pitchers and like Sal Frelick playing left field.
Yeah, it is interesting if you go position by position how it would shake out. I think I would take Contreras over this injured version of Will Smith.
Yes.
But other than that, it's, you know, if you do it that way. But again, this is another thing, a misconception, is you might say, well, surely it was the Dodgers C team and they were throwing out, you know, Matt Sauer there for complete games.
Whoa.
I'm sorry. I was just looking at, I had a story. I was just talking to our lovely editor, Amy Brockman, about this. And I did a story at the beginning of July, like state of the Dodgers rotation. And it's like, here are all the pitchers that have thrown as starting pitchers for the Dodgers this year. And it is a hilarious list. And Matt Sauer is very high on the list. And so again, it's just like how far we've come. But anyway, I bring that up because, okay, no, they faced Glasnow twice. They faced Yamamoto and knocked him out in the first inning. They faced a pretty good version of Kershaw at the time. And, you know, they crushed Emmett Sheehan. So that's not Blake Snell, who's going to start game one. That's not a version of Yamamoto that I'm sure is going to be better than he was in that first game where he couldn't get out of the first inning. And we know Kershaw is not going to start any of these games. They obviously haven't faced Otani. But there's something to that. You know, Quinn Priester dominated the Dodgers, and Freddy Peralta faced him twice and was pretty good. Jose Quintana had a lot of success against the Dodgers. And honestly, based on the lefties' success against the Dodgers for the Phillies, you have to expect Jose Quintana is going to be extremely important in this series as well. And they won some close games. They won some blowouts. They kind of won every style of game. The Dodgers bullpen was, of course, blowing it left and right in both of these series. But two sweeps is two sweeps. And this was not April. This was in July. And, the Dodgers hitters were mostly healthy there. So you can view it both ways. You look at those box scores. There's reasons to be encouraged by what Milwaukee has already accomplished. And there's reasons to think it's going to be a bit of a different beast here in October.
Who you got?
I am going to – so my pick is easy now because the Phillies are out. So now I'm kind of free to go wherever I want instead of sticking with my original pick. I am going to go Dodgers in six, I think. Dodgers in six. What do you think?
So my biggest concern here for the Brewers is just Otani waking up. And – because the Dodgers beat the Phillies really without any offense, significant offense from Betts, Freeman, Otani. And I just don't think that happens for another series. Now, Otani's career postseason numbers are relatively underwhelming. I mean, if he hadn't been carried by Tommy Edman to glory last year, maybe we would be talking about him the way we're talking about Aaron Judge. That being said, I think he does some stuff in this series. Man, I want this to go the distance. This is a juicy series. I think I also want to take the Dodgers so that like I just want to give the Brewers more fuel.
Yeah,
you know, like I really want them to feel slighted.
Yeah, I think that that's what they want.
Here's the thing.
I think that
here's the thing, dude. That. If you look at these rosters and you're like, "Give me the Brewers," like you're wrong. Like that's wrong. You know what I mean? Like. If you're going guy for guy and you pick the Brewers, you're an idiot, right? If you pick the Brewers, you're picking the Brewers because it's like you watched them a lot and you understand that they are greater than the sum of their parts. But I have not seen the Brewers play since they're just going to win the baseball games, right? It's like how are they going to win the baseball games? I don't know. So that's kind of where I'm at. I'm so excited for this series. I hope that they don't lay the David Goliath narrative on too thick, right? I do think it's funny that the Dodgers are like, no, they're the best team in baseball. We're these cute little helpless underdogs. It's like, okay, like they have more wins.
Well, we'll see. We'll see how that goes. I hope that the Brewers make this interesting because regardless of what the regular season things say, like here's the thing. If they beat the Dodgers, it is still going to be presented as, oh my God, they beat the Dodgers. it's not going to be like, oh, yeah, of course, the best team won. It is going to be a huge deal.
That would be so funny. Like, Roberts gets to the podium. Like, the Brewers win in seven. Roberts goes to the podium. Better team won, as we all expected.
Hey, you know.
Like, I don't care. Field, I don't care that baseball. They have Dodgers have more wins.
We battled. I'm proud of what we've put together. It's like, no. Dodgers are expecting to win the World Series again. So we will see how that goes. We don't know when Ohtani's going to pitch. We don't know when he's going to hit either, I guess. Or when he's going to start hitting again, I should say, more accurately. We know he's going to be in the lineup. And we will see if he wakes up. All right. So what are you saying? Dodgers in six, seven,
seven.
Eight, five?
Seven.
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 All right, you'll go Dodgers.
Seven. Three.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we return, a quick farewell to the Tigers and Cubs. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast, a quick final segment. Unfortunately for the Detroit Tigers, their season is over. But hey, Tigers fans, you can go root on the Han Shin Tigers, who are one of the last four teams standing in NPB on the other side of the world.
Yeah, that'll be real solace.
That's why I'll be like, don't worry, it's fine. We go root for the you Tigers. Get fans, the
Tigers. Tigers are just like, Oh, we're good. I can go watch it's fine. That wasn't the most heartbreaking loss ever.
Can we get the GMAC cash? Tigers won again about Han Shin's quest for another championship with like some references to John Duplantier, who's been unbelievable for them. All right. Okay. Anyway, the Detroit Tigers season is over. The Tigers lost again. Obviously, when you lose in that kind of fashion in a game five, you feel like you got so close. And in some ways, that is accurate. And it is true that the Tigers battled in a pretty remarkable way, and that their pitching, obviously led by Skubal, but really the guys even that came in afterwards, they really gave him. And that was the version of the Tigers that we saw earlier this year, at the end of last year, where it was like they are finding ways to get outs. And at the end of the day, that offensive kind of middle of the order was simply not good enough. And that proved to be true down the stretch. And that really proved to be true in some of their most glaring postseason losses this year. And while they were able to battle back and, you know, get their revenge on Cleveland and push Seattle to five games, which is no small feat, they are now one of the teams entering the offseason with some just huge kind of existential questions. And Tarek Skubal and his 1 year remaining on his contract is, of course, the headliner there, as well as just kind of how they want this era to go. Do they want to push it all in for Skubal one more year? Do they want to just pay Skubal, as I think many people reasonably could argue? Where do they go from here? Was this a missed opportunity? Was this one of their best opportunities? Or are they still kind of building up and this is still the beginning of a window, which some teams, of course, have believed in the past only to fall back to mediocrity or worse in the case of some teams that we are familiar with, like the
Orioles, Cubs, whatever.
Where are you thinking about the Tigers right now?
This team was never going to win the World Series as currently constructed. Like, this offense was never, they were never going to do it. Now, it's easy to say that now in the, you know, afterglow of their horrific 15-inning performance, but they just didn't have enough big boys, adult hitters in this lineup. Like, it was Cary Carpenter and a couple of his friends from school is what it felt like. And I think that dates back to the deadline, and it is a failure of this organization to not fully take advantage of having the best pitcher on the planet. They lost both of the games that Tarek Skubal started in this series, and that had nothing to do with Tarek Skubal, right? When you have a player like this who moves the needle so definitively, who is like a 79% chance win every time he walks onto the field, you owe it to that guy, yourself, and the fan base to be in a stronger position than they were in. Look, it is still admirable that the Tigers and AJ Hinch and their interchangeable pieces were able to do what they did. You know what's better than interchangeable pieces? Good freaking baseball players. And the Tigers did not have enough of those on the position player side. And that is incredibly disappointing. Where do they go from here? I do not think that the strategy will change. I do not think that they will swing a move for a big bat or sign a huge free agent hitter. Because I don't think that that's how this front office is approaching it. I think this is going to be more like the Orioles, who are saying, hey, we have enough good young pieces here. Let's let it all play out. The difference is that the clock is ticking on Skubal, right? He is a free agent after the 2026 season. Now, yes, the potential lockout looms and may impact that. Just pay that man his money. Like, no one, if you pay Skubal and you get like three more good years and then he blows up, no one's going to be like, I can't believe you paid Skubal. Even like the Nats paying Steven Strasburg, like, I know that that was incredibly destructive for the franchise. I understand. Yeah. But when you look back on it, it's like, well, yeah, you paid Steven Strasburg, you know? Now, yeah, you know what? I'm gonna rescind that. That's a bad example. That's actually a really bad example.
Well,
because
also,
Strasburg, like, yeah, whatever. That's a bad comparison. But you get my overall point here, which is like, you have Skubal. He's on your team. You will not find another guy like that. Give that man his money. Put the chips in. Like,
yeah.
No one hangs wild card banners.
Nope. Sad irony that the team that, you know, oh, we mix and match, we're willing to pinch hit, didn't use their bench at all in game five. Nobody pinch hit at any point. And that's because the Mariners have all these righties that they weren't going to pinch hit against any of these other guys. Again, and that also speaks to like, okay, well, then the guys that are still in the lineup and getting five, six at-bats maybe aren't necessarily good enough. All that said, they do have some impressive prospects coming, Max Clark, Kevin McGonigal, but that's more of a like 2027 thing in terms of like they're good big leaguers now. Maybe they'll prove me wrong next year. I'll end the Tigers kind of very not positive segment on a positive note, which is that Troy Melton is going to be awesome, and they have their catcher because Dylan Dingler is a freaking stud. And that guy is absolutely like, and I've said this about everyone, this is even before Cal Raleigh became an MVP candidate. If you know who your catcher is, that is a great feeling. And they know who their catcher is. Dylan Dingler is a beast, and that they should feel really good about. And I think Troy Melton is going to be awesome as well in the rotation next year. But their like whole bullpen is going to be, or a lot of their bullpen is going to be reliever, is going to be free agents. Glaber's leaving. A lot of questions to answer this offseason, even if that doesn't have to do with Skubal. Speaking of questions to answer this offseason, the Chicago Cubs are also done, and Kyle Tucker may be done there as well. They have let's start here. This is kind of a lazy way to do it, but I think this is a team where I'm interested in. Was this a good season for the Cubs? Was this a successful season, would you say?
Yeah, I think it was. I think it was. I think if they have Cade Horton, they probably win this series. Right?
Yeah, like, you make that case. Yep.
Cade Horton was one of the best pitchers in baseball down the stretch, was hurt. The Cubs needed one more arm. Now, they didn't hit at all in the deciding game five, and that is pretty relevant. I do think on the whole, yeah, like they had a 5-year drought. I guess they made it in 2020, so 21, 22, 23, 24, when they made it this year.
Hadn't won a game.
I think this was a successful season, first postseason victory since 2017.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's disappointing because they went in for Tucker and then didn't supplement the roster sufficiently at the deadline, which we said at the time. And it just leaves a lot of open questions about how this team is built moving forward. If Tucker walks, do they put Seiya on the outfield? Do they try and go bring Schwarber home and have him be the DH? What the heck is PCA now? I think he'll figure it out a little bit more than he did in the second half. Is like, how good is this farm system? They just gave Jed Hoyer, who's their Pobo, an extension. I don't know.
Yeah. I think I agree with you that this was a successful season. Some big questions to answer even beyond Tucker. Basically, their whole bullpen is hitting free agency besides Palencia because they patched it together with like minor league free agents and waiver claims and whatnot, and credit to them. But that just means you have a lot of innings to replace. And I will also say that, and we can finish on this, from a like a baseball karmic standpoint, this felt like the right result in Cubs Brewers. For the Cubs to then just show up and immediately beat the Brewers, for all the Brewers have kind of been through since they're getting so close, it felt like they earned, they dealt with the lows of losing the postseason over and over and over, that they earned that series win. Whereas if the Cubs just like showed back up and just went back to the World Series, that would have felt like, okay, they would have earned it. They're a good team. But it doesn't really feel like narratively the right thing to happen. It feels like the Cubs still need to go back and like really feel the pain of losing in the playoffs again and understand, okay, this is what we need. This is what was not good enough. And now we can get back to being an annual NL contender. That's going to be on the front office, though, because they have, while they proved some stuff this year in some of the ways that they built the roster to get back to the postseason fairly comfortably, all things considered, there are still some pretty big questions about the foundation, I would say, of this group.
Yeah.
But I mean, the infield is obviously set. They still, PCA is at the very least the best defensive center fielder and a good hitter. You know, Hap's still good. Suzuki finishing strong is really encouraging. This is still a good team. I think we're going to be pretty optimistic about going into next year, but they certainly have a lot of work to do. Cubs fans, let us know, was this a successful season or not? All right, we're done. Game 2 between the Mariners and Blue Jays coming up later tonight. Game 1, Cubs and Brewers, of course. We will be back on Wednesday following the second game of the Dodgers and Brewers. I will be in Seattle, waking up early on the West Coast to pod that morning, and I cannot wait. So thank you all for listening. Thank you to Andrew Hartz and Angered Rosas for producing. As always, we appreciate it. You can email us at baseballbarbercast@gmail.com. Jake Mintz, enjoy the poutine, and I will talk to you soon, my friend.